We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is the second hour of Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about how it is the news media cover natural disasters. Reporting on the recent earthquake in Haiti led many people to criticize the news media for a number of things, for overplaying the chaos and destruction, for sometimes crossing the line between reporting the story and being the story, and all of that in the service of ratings. So that leads to some rather big and important questions like, well, in a story like this, how much coverage is too much? And do the personal feelings of reporters belong in the story? And then another question, well, what happens to this story after the big news outlets leave? This morning in this part of the show, we'll try to talk, as I said, a little bit about the way the news media cover natural disasters. And our guest for the program is Barbie Zelizer. She is professor of communication at the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania, where she holds the Raymond Williams Chair of Communication, and she is also director of the Scholars Program in Culture and Communication. She's interested in the cultural dimensions of journalism. She has contributed to a number of books, and she's served as the editor of three that I just want to mention, particularly because they deal with the kind of issues that we're talking about here, the most recent being The Changing Faces of Journalism, Tabloidization, Technology, and Truthiness, published by Routledge just last year. She's also the co-editor of the book Reporting War, Journalism in Wartime, and also a book titled Journalism After September 11. As we talk, comments, questions from listeners are welcome, and we certainly are interested in your participation. We do hope that people can keep their comments brief, but other than that, people want to call in, certainly that's welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call, use that, and that is 800-222-9455. We will also take your questions by email. So you email them to will-talk, that's W-I-L-O, will-talk at illinois.edu. Professor Zelizer, hello.
Good morning, David.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
You know, these kinds of questions, they certainly are not new. People raised, I'm sure, the same questions about the coverage of Katrina. Certainly they did. Maybe not quite as much, but I'm sure the same questions were raised about the Asian tsunami. And, you know, just about any time we have something of this magnitude that draws the attention of the international media and is seen as a big breaking story, people will indeed raise these questions. But I wonder if in the particular case of Haiti, it seemed that, you know, these questions or the sort of the intensity with which they're being discussed was something a little bit more than I've seen in the past. And I wonder whether you think something about this story or something about the way that the American news media responded was different from what's happened in the past?
Well, I think that the images that we saw in Haiti were a little bit more graphic. They were a little bit greater in number. They were a little bit more prominent than we tend to see in other natural disasters. But really, in terms of anything other than scale, I think that the coverage of the earthquake in Haiti followed very conventional, very formulaic lines that we tend to find around any natural disaster. Mm. And that is a turn to the visual, more pictures, more memorable pictures, more frequent pictures, more prominent pictures that kind of take over the news space. The issue here, of course, was that many of those pictures actually portrayed corpses. And it has become a very conventional public response to complain about the graphicness of such images, certainly in the last few decades.
And this, I suppose here we some of these concerns will also overlap. We could ask some of the same questions about coverage of war. coverage of incidents of terrorism. Some of the same questions apply. That is, what sort of images do you need to tell the story? What sort of is there some sort of a line that one can easily cross? How do reporters and news media think about that?
Yeah, those are all excellent questions. And I think that it's very important to recognize that actually natural disaster, war, torture, terrorism, epidemic, large-scale accidents, they all take on the same formulaic kinds of depictions. And I think that the question of what kinds of pictures are best able to kind of depict what it is happening is a problematic question, because the pictures should show us what is going on. And so the question of overplaying the chaos and overplaying the destruction, when the chaos and destruction are what drive the story, I think raises the more important question, which is why are we so reticent about seeing in pictures what we're not reticent about hearing in words? I think that we need to be thinking about words and pictures in the news as quite equal partners that convey different kinds of information but are equally important. And if we're not willing to hear the words of a story, if we're not willing to hear the actual verbal information, or we are willing to hear the verbal information, we should be willing to see the visual information as well.
Yeah. I suppose that the argument would be that the words and the pictures engage people in different ways, or they engage different parts of us, and because of that, the response is going to be different. And so then you might ask, well, what's the difference between something that is a slightly more emotional response as opposed to something that is a slightly more rational response? And does that help? Does one or the other help you understand things any better?
Right. I think that's exactly the issue. Of course, we've long known that images tend to play on the emotions. They tend to play on suggestion. They tend to play on the imagination. But I think that it's important to recognize that the ways in which we engage with events, particularly natural disasters or war or terrorism, is through the emotions. I think that the idea that somehow words convey a rational, linear, reasoned engagement with what's going on in the world around us is correct, but we also need our emotions as a way to make sense of that rational, reasoned information. And so the idea that somehow images are going to unleash a very frenzied emotional public create all kinds of problematic emotional responses, including responses having to do with appropriateness and decency, I think is really skirting the point. If we expect images to convey information as part of the journalistic record, then I think we have to allow them to do what it is they do best, and figure out how we're going to engage with that rather than, you know, screaming and shouting every time an image that is just a wee bit too graphic or too vulgar somehow hits our front pages or our home pages and causes us to somehow recoil in shock or horror or disgust. Mm-hmm. I think shock and horror and disgust are part of our engagement with the images, with the events that these images are actually depicting.
Do you in fact think that looking at the Haiti coverage, that the people who were critical or were saying that there was too much attention given to the dimensions of chaos and destruction, and for example, there was at one point where there was looting going on, and that media reported on that because it was happening, and some people reacted very strongly to that and said, well, you know, maybe that's not even the right word to apply to this because we have people who have been stripped of the most basic means of survival, and so what they're trying to do is survive. And I guess I just wonder what you think about all that.
Yeah, well, again, I mean, I think that if any kind of action is unfolding on the ground, I think it deserves pictures. And I know that I'm probably in somewhat of a minority position on this. But I think we have to ask more generally, why is it that we're willing to see pictures of very graphic violence, pictures of death, pictures of corpses and body parts, every place else in our mediated environment? And here I include television, I include film, I include the online environment, and yet in the one record that we really need that information in order to act as informed and responsible citizenry, we're not willing to see it. I think that there are always errors in terms of how things are framed, in terms of how things are labeled, and I do understand the issue about whether or not what was going on was a fight for survival or looting, but I don't think that that changes by virtue of us not seeing it. I think it is important for us to see it.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Barbie Zelizer, she's professor of communication and holds the Raymond Williams Chair of Communication. She's also director of the Scholars Program in Culture and Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at University of Pennsylvania. We're talking some about this morning about the way that media, news media, cover natural disaster. And this certainly some of these same questions, as we have discussed here, overlap into other kinds of stories. Certainly it's true of war, of terrorism, a lot of other areas. The same sorts of questions apply. Your comments, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Something else that we're seeing more and more, and I think that it does concern people, and it's something that's worth talking about, is the how it is that the reporters become involved in the story. And I think that some people think that we, in some cases, have really crossed the line between reporters covering the story and reporters being the story or being in the story, and feeling that in addition to reporting it, it's important or at least allowable for them to be communicating something of their own personal experience. And something that we seem to be seeing more and more, particularly in television. And I wonder how you think about that and how people who think about media think about that.
Yeah, I think that people are pretty divided on this. I think if you look historically, clearly the reporter's involvement in the story has long been the kind of justifying impulse that made it worthwhile to look at a reporter. The whole idea of an eyewitness report, of course, was a very subjective, personal testimony to whatever the reporter was actually seeing on the ground. And so the idea of, you know, personal feelings and personal involvement, I think, has always been there, although certainly with the rise of a belief in objectivity and claims to the capacity to offer a kind of dispassionate, impartial reportage, the hope was that feelings would kind of be shunted out of the story. I think that my personal view on this is that if the reporter is there and if the reporter has some skill that makes sense, and of course the case of Sanjay Gupta comes to right to the forefront in terms of his performing surgery while he was there doing coverage, I think that that makes sense. I think that that's okay. I think that every pair of hands in a disaster is necessary and helpful. And I guess my question would be, why would we expect journalists to be any less human than anybody else who is in a disaster area?
But that, well, I think that's a really interesting case. I don't know that you can find too many others like that. He who works for CNN, reporting on health issues, but he's also an MD. He's a physician, and so he was there and had the kind of skills that they definitely needed. That, though, in my mind, leads to this question: well, what are you? Maybe you have to say, I'm going to do one or the other. Can you really fulfill both those roles? Or if you get there and if you say more than another reporter, what they need here is a doctor, and I am a doctor, so that's what I'm going to do.
And I think that is a decision that he took. I you're right in the sense that there aren't many like him, but I think that the question of having skills that are required to be a journalist in a disaster area versus having skills that are required just to be an individual helping, that tension always exists. And as a former reporter myself, I worked for Reuters for many years. I know that there are many situations in which the capacity to help, you know, looms very large and often gets kind of intertwined in the capacity to report. So I guess what I would wonder is why do we expect journalists to kind of vacate that dimension of their human engagement with whatever it is they're reporting on? I think that that's at some level an unrealistic expectation.
Mm. Let us talk with a caller, someone who's listening this morning in Indiana and is calling on our toll-free line, line 4, right here. Hello.
Hello. This is similar to what you both were talking about. I'm looking at it in terms of feedback. In terms of the geography of the situation, so what I'm sort of interested in, who's controlling what? I can see reporters doing about anything, but there's a fellow that's, you know, pointing his finger at a cameraman or doing a toggle switch that of 5 or 6 things that are available, he's choosing one of those to be shown on the tube. And print matter, you can't do that more or less, or you have, you know, everybody'd have a New York Times every day sort of thing. The other situation is, do the reporters ever get a chance to see how their material is utilized and put on the tube for others to see? And in any case, whether that would have effect on them, then we get into this thing about emotional quality and whether or not I can disengage myself or whether actually I'm a doctor and a reporter, and I'm also trying to put a good face on for international media. It seems very complex to me. I think in some sense all of it just falls aside and people do what they do, and that's all. Thanks.
Yeah, you actually raised two very important questions, and one is the point that most photographers, most photojournalists who do take pictures are not the individuals who make the choices about which images get shown in the news media. It's usually page editors, photo editors, picture editors, whatnot, who will look at the footage or look at the digital files and make the decision about which images to push. So that often you have these situations where photojournalists, way after the fact, because of course they're distant from the actual home organization, will find out that their picture actually got great play in Newsweek or Time or whatnot. Combined with that, of course, however, as you rightly suggest, you know, the mediated environment is such that pictures are going up online without any kind of trending through a news organization. So it's very easy to get pictures taken by private citizens or people on the ground, humanitarian workers, aid workers, that might rival or might parallel what it is we're actually seeing in the bona fide news media. You know, the mediated environment today is extremely complex. There are many venues for the display of images, all of which, getting back to David's original question, which is the kind of lament about the depiction of chaos and destruction, I think makes that lament even more curious, given the fact that these images are out there all the time.
Hmm. And I guess I would think it would also be important to make the point that for people who are reporters who are writing stories for print outlets, no matter what the outlet is, there are editors, and someone may be on the scene, may be reporting a story, and may write it a particular way, but that doesn't necessarily mean that when it gets into the paper or online or wherever it's going, that it's written just the way they wrote it.
Right. Absolutely.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Champaign, line number 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. My big beef with disaster coverage is in the acute initial phases, just the repetitiveness and the saturation and the lack of apparent involvement of the local reporters. You know, like in this Haiti thing, where were the Haitian journalists? Why didn't anyone ever hand a Haitian journalist a microphone and put him in front of a camera, you know, so we can get some deeper insights? You know, it's always the same big media reporters, you know, the big figures, and it's just so repetitive. And I never see them, at least outwardly, involving the local journalists at all. I don't know if it happens behind the scenes, but they don't give them a world stage at all. Thanks.
That's an excellent point, and I can't agree with you more. And it's not only that they didn't involve the local journalists, but they didn't involve the local citizens. I mean, particularly in Haiti, there's a whole group of NGOs that have been training people on the ground in participatory photography. One group, I think, is called Zanmi Lakai, that was founded by a couple from Pacifica, California, that has been dedicated really to using photography in the streets to improving the lives of Haitians, which of course has been problematic not only since the earthquake, but for many years running. And so where were they? Where were those pictures? Where was that documentation? We really did not see it.
I guess one thing, just for a second, I'm interested in coming back to is the how it is the proliferation of what I suppose, for want of a better term, you might call citizen journalism, the ability for people to record events and to put them up on the web, is changing the way that regular news organizations do things. I guess one of the things that I'm really struck by, and maybe people are familiar with, is that just recently the George Polk Awards in journalism for 2009 were announced, and these are very prestigious awards, and they're given out every year, and that they gave the award for videography this year to whomever it was that was responsible for recording the shooting of this young woman in Iran who was protesting the presidential elections in June,
yes.
Neda Agha Sultan.
Yes.
Somebody captured that. They put it on the internet. We don't know who, but it was something that was very, images were very disturbing and very powerful, were seen around the world. Now, I'm not sure something like, well, it has happened before that awards have been given anonymously, and later on we found out who was responsible. We don't know if we will ever know who it was who did this. But I wonder how it is that the fact that we have more and more things like this, and now here it's been actually acknowledged with a major award, does that change the way that broadcast news organizations or other news organizations think about how it is they cover things and how it is they put the stories out?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a very slow change. I think that as an institution, journalism is very reluctant to change. And so what we're seeing is a kind of resigned acceptance or recognition of the fact that, you know, there are people out there who are taking their own pictures, blogging their own blogs, giving their own accounts at a pace that is often much faster than anything that can be provided by mainstream or the recognizable venues of mainstream journalism. I will say that, you know, the kind of adjacent presence of amateurs alongside professional journalists has been there forever. I mean, from the very beginning, I mean, if you go all the way back to, you know, the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, I mean, that was recorded by you know, people running through the rubble of San Francisco trying to get their pictures, and it was one of the most fully recorded natural disasters in history, pictorially recorded. But I think that it's important to recognize that what we have today is that the pace by which people are able to take a picture, post it, and get it online and get it out there is extraordinary. We saw that with the tsunami. Mm-hmm. We saw that with Hurricane Katrina. And we've seen it with with other kinds of disasters like the London subway bombing and whatnot. But I think that absolutely journalism is beginning to change. It is beginning to make calls. There are requests for pictures and blogs from citizens on the ground. Some of the news organizations actually have places on their websites through which people can actually provide their own documents. So, yes, this is changing. Whether or not it is actually making mainstream journalists and mainstream news organizations change their own practices in terms of how much they're willing to let the space be taken over time rather than just in conjunction with a particular disaster, I think we're not there yet.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Barbie Zelizer. She is professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania, where she holds the Raymond Williams Chair of Communication. She's also director of the Scholars Program in Culture and Communication at the Annenberg School there. And she's interested in her work on the cultural dimensions of journalism, is the editor of a book, The Changing Faces of Journalism, Tabloidization, Technology, and Truthiness, published by Routledge last year. Also, just to name a couple of other books that she was involved in, she was co-editor of the book Reporting War, Journalism in Wartime, in 2004, and also co-editor of Journalism After September 11, that was published in 2002. The same publisher in all these cases, Routledge. And questions are welcome. We're talking here about media coverage of natural disaster, but some of these questions certainly do overlap into other kinds of stories. And your questions, your comments are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Back when we were just starting out, and I was asking you maybe for some general comments on the Haiti coverage, you talked about the fact that when you started to see the stories, that the narrative followed some rather conventional lines when it comes to stories like this. And I wonder what is that, and how did this, if that's true, how did this kind of frame that is often used to frame these kinds of stories, how did that develop?
Yes, if I could use this moment to plug a book of mine that's coming out called About to Die, How News Images Move the Public, which will be out with Oxford University Press in August. In which I actually deal exactly with this topic, in the sense that what we often get, what we get, I think, more than what we need, are stories about human anguish. What we don't get are stories that focus on the structural circumstances that tend to underlie or at some points cause many of the natural disasters that we look at as being solely natural. In terms of poverty, in terms of lack of sanitation, in terms of unhygienic conditions, all of which, the spread of disease, all of which goes along with natural disasters in many parts of the world. And I think that that's part of the reason, certainly, why Haiti perhaps did get a little bit more graphic coverage. I think that Haiti has occupied a place in at least the American public imagination as a place of true tragedy, true impoverishment, misfortune. If you looked at all of the headlines right after the earthquake happened, it was, you know, another Haiti tragedy. And I think that at some level made it easier to look at pictures of corpses, to show pictures of corpses in this particular tragedy than we might have seen in other tragedies.
Well, and I think that it also gets at concerns that people have about the way that these stories are covered, that the story breaks and there's this immediate drive for good reasons and maybe some questionable reasons for news media to be there. And now we have 24-hour channels that have to have material, and in television you've got to have pictures. And so here's a very big, dramatic, breaking story, and you feel like, okay, we've got to be there. And what you do when you get there, I'm sure, is that you're, as a reporter, you're confronted with these dramatic, heartbreaking things, and you say, okay, this is the big story, and you point your camera there. Well, that doesn't really give us an opportunity to ask questions that maybe should be asked, questions like, well, how did we get here, and why is this like this, and what's the nature of the response, and what's going to come next? So you don't take the opportunity. You can't ask those questions while you're in the middle of the story. But then the additional sort of criticism is that at some point you're going to leave. You're going to go back to what you were doing before. Maybe you're going to go on to whatever the next thing is, and you'll never come back to that story to ask those kinds of questions.
That's right, and that's where the whole notion of the news hole, the idea that, you know, that the news hole, there's only so much that this imaginary news hole can actually hold, although, of course, it's much bigger today now that we're online than it ever was before. But the point is that there is only so much attention that can be held by a natural disaster. And once that attention wanes, reporters are off to another story. And so getting to those very important questions that are central, I believe, to understanding more fully how these natural disasters, how war, how terrorism actually comes about, often get missed simply because journalism has moved on to a new story by the time they're able to actually start asking them.
Yeah, and you wonder, as news organizations, because of the tremendous financial pressures that they're facing, they're cutting back on staff. They're cutting back on, I'm sure that newspapers no doubt will be cutting back on pages, and news programs will be cutting back on time. Just recently here, there's been now a big story has broken about how ABC News is laying off a whole bunch of people. You'd have to wonder, as things go forward here, if the number of reporters and the opportunities for doing stories shrink. Are those stories going to get done? These kind of stories, is anybody going to do them?
Right. But then we get back to the question that was raised by one of your earlier callers, which is, well, then why aren't news organizations looking more toward locals, looking more toward citizen journalists, looking more toward different sources of information to buttress and bolster their own attempts at news gathering? I mean, I think that's an obvious source of information, and often a source of the more structural information that I'm talking about, rather than the immediate response to human anguish, that should be getting included more regularly and more stridently in the news, particularly as they're facing their own cost-cutting initiatives.
We'll talk with another caller here, someone on our line number one. Hello.
Yes, I have some problems with the media, and I wonder if they are transformed from the journalism that is taught at a highly regarded school like the Annenberg School at Penn, to when they get to the media, especially cable news, but to some degree even the mainstream, whereby there are some influences that come into being that have more to do with entertainment, ratings, and you don't necessarily tune into these disaster recoveries after a point to get news. For example, with Haiti, I kept waiting, and maybe I missed it, because at some point in time I got turned off with the gore, and I'm a military person of 22 years, and I've seen corpses, but if you corpses, or you see children mutilated, losing limbs, I mean, at some point in time, there is overkill. And I know you think we should look at images to tell us what's happening, but I don't need to see corpses, mutilated children. At some point in time, I get the image, I get the graphicness, I get the suffering of the Haitian people. But what I see, and I kept waiting for it, Haitian people have a unique culture. And a part of their problem, and everybody went down there and said, oh, how impoverished they were, and now they're even worse shape. It was a part of the problem is the colonialism of the United States and the French toward Haiti, primarily because through Toussaint Louverture, they overthrew French colonization. And they have been subject to embargoes. They had to pay back reparations to the French. The United States has perpetually invaded Haiti and choked it off from resources. And if people had a historical background, if the media were really interested in giving us the full picture, that would have been brought to the forefront instead of wringing our hands about how these black people are so impoverished and so poor without understanding the rich history of the Haitians in overcoming the yoke of colonialism and slavery. And that's always the superficiality I find with this media.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, these are part of the structural circumstances that I'm referring to. I think that television faces this with a much greater degree than say the print media, where I think you can find a little bit of that attention to who the Haitians are, where their strength has come from, what kinds of belief systems have sustained them through enormous and sustained misfortunes over time. But the media simply are no longer set up to be able to delve into a story with that kind of depth. And so we miss it. We absolutely miss it.
Well, when you miss it, and I'm not considering myself an intelligent person, even though I do think I'm an intelligent person, when I see what's going on is superficial, ratings-obsessed, skewed, and in a way it reflects laziness, because I never saw a show or a picture outside of Port-au-Prince, mm-hmm. Other than to say we can't get to the other places. And I just accepted that as a very narrow, superficial coverage of the Haitian.
To be fair, a lot of them couldn't get out of Port-au-Prince. I mean,
yeah, but I've got a feeling some of them could.
You have to also recognize that, you know, when you're dealing with natural disaster, these are tough stories to cover. They're tough stories. You need immediate feedback. You need immediate. You can't always get the kind of confirmation or corroboration of you know, any kind of rumor that's going around. You're on the ground and you know, really short on resources, but needing to provide information with very high stakes. So I think I think we have to recognize that there is a difficulty with that. At the same time, you know, I think that they can be doing better, and I agree. I absolutely agree with you on that point.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And once again, we have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus, talking about media, particularly talking about media coverage of natural disasters like Haiti, for example. And our guest is Barbie Zelizer. She's professor of communication at the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking, certainly would welcome your questions, your comments. You want to be involved in the conversation, that's great. 333-9455. We also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And email also is a possibility. You can send along your comments that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm interested now, because you mentioned that the forthcoming book, the one from Oxford, at the end of the summer, the title, About to Die, How News Images Move the Public. And I'm interested in having you talk about how news images move the public,
mm-hmm.
Whether there are I'm sure that you can think of a number of dramatic images that might well have influenced public opinion one way or another about some particular event, and then that may or may not go on to influence policy. Are there some particularly strong examples you think about news images that have moved the public?
Absolutely. Well, the title of my book, which I shamelessly plugged.
That's okay with me. I think that's fine. I got no problem with that.
The book actually looks at how news organizations routinely use pictures of people facing death instead of pictures of corpses around the unsettled events of the public sphere. So we're talking torture, terrorism, natural disaster, epidemic, war. And, you know, we've already mentioned a number of them. The picture of Neda in Tehran last summer, pictures from the Intifada of there was a very famous picture of a very contested picture, I might say, of Mohammed al-Dura, who was a little 12-year-old boy, shot to death in the Gaza Strip. All of the iconic, or most of the iconic images of Vietnam, the shooting of General Lone, the My Lai massacre, these are all of pictures facing death, of people facing death. And my argument has been is that they push the emotions, they push the imagination, they push contingency, they offer a kind of engagement with the news that does not necessarily come with understanding, but they push public involvement. And so these images have been used over time by various people, not just news organizations, but certainly members of militias, government officials, prosecutorial tribunals, humanitarian workers, to push public sentiment about difficult, contested, and unsettled events in various ways.
One thing that, I don't know, you know, to what extent this is something that interests you, but I guess one thing that I think about is how it is that the people that are telling these stories, the people that are bringing them to us, deal with the emotional experience of what it is that they're seeing and reporting on. And you know, one of the things I guess I just think about it, for example, is that some weeks back, early on in the Haiti coverage, one afternoon on All Things Considered, they had one of their reporters, I think it was Jason Beaubien, who was there and had, if I remember right, he had landed in the neighboring country and had somehow managed to drive in. And they had him live on the line, and he was describing what he was seeing. And I'm not sure if that was live as we were hearing it, or there would have been some opportunity for them to do some editing if they so chose. But it was a really stunning moment, because I can't think of too many other times that I have heard what seemed to be live on the air, a reporter literally breaking down because he was overcome by what he was seeing. Which makes me wonder, you know, how do you do that if you are sent to describe some event and you're there? I guess if you're a photographer, you turn your camera on the image and you click the shutter. But if you're actually in the position to have to describe it, how it is you deal with your own emotional response to what it is you're seeing, and not have that be something that overwhelms you to the point where you're literally speechless.
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and I think that it's important to remember. I mean, it gets back to the question you raised earlier about how can personal feeling, how about becoming part of the story. Mm-hmm. I mean, to expect that journalists or photographers could keep their personal feelings out of the story, particularly when the story is so horrific and so awful to watch unfold, I think is just naive. And you know, photographers routinely, regularly share stories about how difficult it is to actually take pictures of some of these awful events, and many of them have actually left photojournalism because they couldn't handle the pressures anymore. I think it's good for us as a public to hear how difficult it is. I think it's good when reporters kind of unmask that impassioned face that they put to things when they're trying to act professional. I think it's important to recognize that they're human beings underneath it all as well.
We have another caller here, Montgomery, Illinois, on our toll-free line. We'll go there, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I'd like to see emotion out of reporters and photographers. I think it kind of, I don't want to say puts a spin on it. Well, I'll say it puts a spin on it. It's more emotional. And the reason I say this, one guy in particular was really good for this was Walter Cronkite. During the 60s and 50s and 60s when they were doing the moon shots and the moon landing and all that, I thought he did an excellent job. Out of all the reporters that I've seen and listened to over the years, I think he was the best at what he did. And, you know, nowadays everything is dry and formatted, and it doesn't tell the whole story. And I think that's what's wrong with the way we get our news nowadays. It's all kind of twisted around, and it really doesn't tell the truth. And I think the public deserves better reporting and better photography. Now, I'll say this: National Geographic. I get this, and I'm sure a lot of other people do the magazine. And then every once in a while, their channel that they have on the TV has great stories and great articles, and their photography and their reporting is bar none the best in the world. Why can't regular, you know, like CNBC or CNN and CBS and ABC and all them get together and format their journalism to be that way? Because all you hear is kind of a biasness and not a fair shake. And it's all formatted towards, let's say, the head honchos in that particular channel. I'll get off the list.
Yes, you actually have 2 points there that I just want to kind of draw out a little bit. The first is, of course, National Geographic is not a daily news organization, which allows it much greater resources, much more latitude, much more the luxury of more time in making decisions and actually producing the images that we see in National Geographic, that I just that would be an unreasonable goal to expect from a daily news organization or a news organization that is faced with the time pressures of having to be online all the time. They don't have the luxury of being able to produce that quality of imagery. Walter Cronkite, I agree. I mean, he was the quintessential news person, and you mentioned his emotions over the moon landings, but I would mention his emotions over reporting the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which of course has become rather folkloric in the record of how a respected news person abandons objectivity. I'm referring, of course, to the point at which he began crying on air, which certainly became a rather formulaic and repeated display of journalistic emotion that many other anchors, including Dan Rather, after him, followed in his footsteps. So I think that the fact that we don't see that kind of emotion anymore leads us to kind of assume that emotion isn't part of the landscape, and I think that we would all do better if we saw more of it.
All right. Another caller here, Chicago, line number one. Hello.
When a picture is supposed to represent 1,000 words, well, what could be more portrayal of things than our experience with the Pearl Harbor and then the mushroom cloud of the atomic bomb explosion and the other things that have occurred as a result of wars. And yet the impact of and the folly of war has not been hit home. The point of natural disasters occurring and things like that that we focus on, the suffering and tragedy of people, and yet the overall sword that is still hanging over everyone that could be devastating the entire planet is the atomic umbrella that we still have to face. Anyway, I thought that there are some pictures that really do portray 1,000 words or more, and yet unless it's of a catastrophic nature like atomic or Pearl Harbor and other ones, we don't get it. As well as focusing on the conditions in other parts of the world where one country may have a war going on for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, what picture can portray that? And even words seem to be falling aside. So we have quite a ways to go to combine all of it so that we can get the fuller impact of all the things that we're trying to discover. Thank you.
Absolutely, and I think that it's important here to recognize again that in much of contemporary warcraft, we simply don't see the civilian devastation on the other side. We don't see military casualties. We don't see battles gone badly. We don't see wounded or captured soldiers, and certainly Hiroshima is the classic example. I actually discuss this in my forthcoming book at some length, the classic example of where we saw a mushroom cloud without any visible evidence of the destruction that it wrought on the ground. If we look at Afghanistan, if we look at Iraq, if we look at all of the battles that are going on around the world right now, we need to recognize that we are not seeing the casualties that they are inflicting, and we're not seeing the corpses in any shape or form that that even comes close to what we saw, for instance, in instances that it was deemed more desirable to look at corpses. And here I'm referring to the liberation of the concentration camps in 1945. That was really the one point in our contemporary existence where we did see corpses, and we saw quite a few corpses. It is significant, I believe, that in no atrocity since then, no battle, no war since then, have we seen anything like that in terms of graphic imagery.
We're getting close to the end of the time. I have an email here that I think raises a kind of interesting point. I'll get you to react to it because it ties into a lot of the things we've been talking about, where the person who's writing in sort of raises this question, the costs of big, high-profile disaster coverage versus, say, investigative coverage. And he writes, well, what's the difference to a news company of sending a star news anchor overseas to cover disasters with all the equipment necessary, the cost of that versus hiring on good investigative reporters? The observation is that investigative reporting seems to be cut more and more, although it's needed now. He says the big news corporations seem to be willing to spend lots of money on things like satellite trucks, but maybe not so much on dogged sort of old-fashioned journalism.
Right. I completely agree, and I think that he's actually answered his own question. The point is that as cost-cutting continues in news organizations, investigative journalism, which tends to be takes more resources. There isn't always the kind of give back, so you can't always justify it as a cost-efficient set of practices. It is one of the first things to go from a news organization.
Yeah, we're coming down to the point we have to finish, and I think that we have raised and talked about some interesting questions, and I think we've gotten at some of the things that we said we would like to. I don't know that we necessarily have answers, but I'm not quite sure that there are clear answers to any of these things, and particularly as now news organizations are really trying to find their way in a very, very new and different media landscape, and that everyone's trying to figure out how to do the job, what it is people want, doing that all in an atmosphere of really severe financial pressures. So what sort of thought would you like to leave with people?
I would like to leave with people the necessity to think about images in very much the same way that they think about words, and that when they complain about images being too graphic or inappropriate or indecent, to ask themselves whether or not they would say that a news story is inappropriate or indecent. My sense is that they would not, and so I would argue for as full visual documentation of what's going on in natural disaster as we get in verbal record.
Hmm. Well, we'll have to stop. Perhaps later on this summer we'll talk about the new book when it comes out. How about that?
Well, thanks, David. I appreciate that. Right. Thanks for having me on.
Our guest, Barbie Zelliger, she's a professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania there at the Annenberg School. She holds the Raymond Williams Chair of Communication. She's also director of the Scholars Program in Culture and Communication there at the University of Pennsylvania.